Welcome back, everyone, for the fifth session of our classes about Parshanut and polemics, the ways in which Jewish Bible commentators over the ages related to Christianity, took on Christianity in their commentaries on the Bible. For the last 2 weeks, we were dealing with Rashi, and we noticed that in Rashi's commentary on the prophets and on the writings on Nevi'im and Ketuvim, he makes a number of references to Christianity, but that in his Torah commentary, he does not. He never does it specifically. And I argued that we can't even see any strong evidence of him alluding to Christianity in his Torah commentary. And at the end of the last session, we speculated a little bit. We don't know why that would be the case, but we speculated a little bit about what might have caused him. Was this a change later in life or something like this that caused him to start dealing with Christianity in his commentaries on the prophets and the writings, or is it something different about the nature of his Torah commentary? Today, we will deal with Rashi's grandson, Rashbam. Every once in a while, because I've spent most of my academic career writing and teaching about Rashbam, I assume that everybody knows who Rashbam is, but I thought that it might be good to just say a few words of introduction for those who don't really know who Rashbam was. Rashi did not have any sons. His daughter Yocheved married one of his students named Meir, and Meir and Yocheved's oldest son was Samuel Shmuel, Rashi's oldest grandson. And probably when Rashi died, Rashbam took over as the head of the yeshiva for a while in Troyes, in France, not too far from Paris. Probably Rashbam spent most of his life working on Talmud. He was one of the Baalei HaTosafot. He was a Tosafist. He wrote and taught in Halakha. But in his Torah commentary, one perhaps finds the strongest emphasis of any medieval rabbi on the plain meaning of the biblical text, the contextual meaning of the biblical text, a willingness to explain the pshat, the plain meaning of the text, even in such a way that it did not conform to what was taught in the Talmud. That's what made him, in my mind, such an interesting person, because he was interested, you know, here's what the text really means. While he obviously had fealty, loyalty to the Talmud, and he allowed the Talmud to control his religious life. On the other hand, he did not allow the Talmudic understandings of the Bible to take over his understanding of the Bible. And perhaps a result of the fact that his Torah commentary was a little bit against the grain, that it wasn't the standard Torah commentary, it wasn't going in the standard pattern of the Talmud and the Midrashim, his commentary was almost lost. One finds in the first centuries after he died, in the 12th century, in the 13th century, in the 14th century, people were quoting the commentary, and then it seems like nobody knows about the commentary because in medieval times, before the printing press, a commentary survived only if people copied the manuscripts and made new copies of the manuscript. And it would seem like people weren't bothering to make copies of the manuscript of Rashbam's Torah commentary. One sole manuscript survived and was found by Rabbi David Oppenheim, a bibliophile who was the chief rabbi of Prague later in life. But in the beginning of his life, when he was still living in Germany, somebody invited him to go to an attic where he found this rotting manuscript that he says that looked like the mice had eaten the beginning of the manuscript and the end of the manuscript. And that's why we don't have the beginning of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah or the end of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. But what we do have in the middle, we do have about 90% of the commentary on the Torah, one would assume, is a very interesting commentary with a very strong interest in the pshat, in the plain meaning of the biblical text. So Rashbam did not have the goal in his Torah commentary of like preserving the Talmudic understandings of the text. He went back and looked straight at the text. But the question is, did he have, when he wrote his commentary, was he thinking about what the Christians were saying about the Torah? And was he taking on Christianity in his own Torah commentary? And the simple answer to that question is yes. As we shall see today, Rashbam perhaps was the first author of a Bible commentary from the standard circles of rabbis that took on Christianity in a number of places in the commentary. And we will look at examples of how Rashbam did this. We saw this verse a few sessions ago, the verse Lo Yasur Shevet mi Yehuda u'mechokek mi ben raglav ad ki yavo Shiloh velo yikat amim. And I gave you here two translations of the verse into English. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, so that tribute shall come to him and the homage of people be his. In the context, this is when Jacob is on his deathbed and he's giving blessings to his sons. This is the blessing he gives to his fourth son, saying that the simple understanding of the verse, of course, is that kings will come from Judah. And that was the case, of course, in later Jewish history. So the first part of the verse, Lo Yasur Shevet mi Yehuda u'mechokek mi ben raglav, is very simple. But the second half, Ad ki yavo Shiloh v'lo yikat amim, is very, very difficult. So that tribute shall come to him and the homage of people will be his. That's what the Jewish Publication Society does in their translation. The King James translation reads, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So that's a very different understanding. So what is Shiloh? So the traditional Christian understanding is that Shiloh is a reference to Jesus, and that monarchy will be in the hands of Judah until Shiloh come, and then the peoples will gather to Shiloh, will gather to Jesus. One can find that already, like in the second century, the church father Justin Martyr is giving a Christological understanding of this verse, writing here, in your nation, there never failed either prophet or ruler from the time when they began until the time when this Jesus Christ appeared and suffered. There never failed to be a prophet among you who was Lord and leader and ruler of your nation, for the spirit which was in the prophets anointed your kings and established them. But after the manifestation and death of Jesus in your nation, there was and is nowhere any prophet. Nay, further, you ceased to exist under your own king. Your land was laid waste and forsaken like a lodge in a vineyard, the image from the prophet Yirmiyah, from the prophet Jeremiah. Justin keeps going back to this passage, to Genesis 49:10, says he speaks, therefore, in the passage relating to Judah, a prince shall not fail from Judah, nor a ruler from his thighs, till that which is laid up for him come, different translation, and he shall be the expectation of the nations. And it is plain that this was spoken not of Judah, but of Jesus. That's what Justin Martyr argued. And this became the standard Christian understanding. Another church father a few years after Justin Martyr says, you know, this is clear. This is what the verse means. Much more clearly still does the book of Genesis foretell this when in the blessing of Judah, out of whose tribe Christ was to come according to the flesh, it even then delineated Christ in the person of that patriarch saying, This is the next verse after 49:10 is 49:11. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. On the pshat level, that verse just means that Judah will be given a section of Eretz Yisrael, of the land of Israel, where there is so much wine. Where I'm living now in Israel is presumably in the territory of Judah, and a lot of grapes are grown around here on the road between Jerusalem and Gush Etzion. You can see a lot of vines there, and it's saying that, you know, wine will be so plentiful in this area that they will be like washing their clothes in the juice of the grapes. But the fact that the poet uses the words here, the blood of grapes, Tertullian is saying, oh, this is obviously a reference to the suffering and the crucifixion of Jesus. In general, the Christian argument about this verse was that the verse means that there will be Jewish power until Jesus comes. And later medieval writers said, take a look at the powerlessness of the Jews today, and you can see that that's what the Hebrew Bible said here, that Jews will have power until Jesus comes, and once Jesus comes, they will cease to have power. You can see that argument already here in Justin Martyr here, after the manifestation and death of our Jesus Christ in your nation, there was and is nowhere any problem. You don't have any leaders. You don't have your own kings. You don't have your land, and it's forsaken the land of Eretz Yisrael. And that is what Christians were arguing was the understanding of this verse. At the risk of becoming a polemicist myself, I will just say that this understanding of the verse is it's as full of holes as Swiss cheese, as we'll see a number of difficulties, but let me just point out that the biggest difficulty is the 49th chapter of Genesis is giving a blessing to each of the children of Jacob, and it's kind of delineating the difference between these children. And it's saying that Judah is the one who's going to have power, the power of kingship. Later on, Christians who read this, perhaps as early as Justin Martyr, were understanding that Judah here didn't mean the tribe of Judah, it meant the Jews. But that jump of saying that there will be Jewish power until Jesus comes, and then there won't be any power after Jesus. That's not what it's talking about. It's not talking about the Jews. It's talking about the tribe of Judah. Furthermore, it's only more or less correct that Jewish power stopped around the time of Jesus, because Jesus was killed 35 to 40 years before the temple was destroyed. So people continued to have, Jews continued to have Jewish power until then. We'll wait with the comments to the end. I'll look at the chat later on. So many Jews simply tended to point out the difficulties in the Christian understanding of this verse, but still they had to come up with an understanding of the verse and of this the strange poetry at the end of the verse, Ad ki avo shilo velo yikat amim. Rashbam comes up with a really curious understanding of this verse that is like different from almost anything that one can find in the history of Jewish interpretation of the Bible. Maybe just to save time, I'll just read it in English. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The kingship that has been granted to him that all 12 of his brothers shall bow low to him. That's what it said just two verses before that. That greatness of his shall not cease, nor shall Mechokek power cease from his progeny until he, in other words, Judah, comes to Shiloh. So Shiloh is not the name of a person. It's not the name of the Messiah. Shiloh is the city, Shiloh, here in Israel. Ad ki yavo Shiloh just means until he comes to Shiloh. But what's that a reference to? In other words, until a Judean king, Rehavam, the son of Solomon, in other words, there was the first kings, David and Solomon, David's son, and Rehavam, Solomon's son. They were from the tribes of Judah, and they had kingship, and they were in charge of all of the other tribes. But that will last only until Rehavam comes to the city of Shiloh, which is near Shechem, to renew the monarchy. There's a story told in the book of Kings of Rehavam coming to Shechem to declare himself the king. However, then the 10 tribes will desert him and proclaim Yeravam the king, leaving only Judah and Benjamin for Rehavam, the son of Solomon. The Judean, Judah's monopoly on monarchy will cease, according to Rashbam's understanding, when King Rehavam comes along. And that's what the verse here means, that the only kings will be from Judah until he comes to Shiloh. And this is a reference to going to Shiloh to set up the monarchy. And that's when the tribe of Judah lost the monopoly on the monarchy. And then what will happen? The Lo Yikat Amim, Rashbam explains, the assemblage of nations that were subordinated by his father Solomon, it is written, for he controlled the whole region west of the Euphrates, gathered together there to proclaim Rehavam king. That's what happened in Shiloh. As it is written, Rehavam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to acclaim him king. And when after that happens, Judah will lose his monopoly on the monarchy, and then there will be the split of the kingship of Israel into two different kingships, with the descendants of the tribe of Judah controlling only the southern kingdom, which has two tribes, but the northern kingdom will be under a different king who is not from the tribe of Judah. It's a very creative and a very interesting interpretation. It's got one really weak link in it, which Rashbam realizes. He didn't have great maps back in those days, but he writes here, Shechem is near Shiloh. See, the problem is that when it gives you the story of Rehavam going to renew the monarchy, it says in the Bible that took place in the city of Shechem, Nablus, and not in Shiloh. Shechem and Shiloh are, you know, near each other, you know, in the sense that Toronto and Barrie are near each other. Well, I guess it's closer than Toronto and Barrie, but or Toronto and Oshawa, maybe, in the sense that Toronto and Oshawa are near to each other, but they're not the same place. So why would the text say Ad ki yavo Shiloh instead of Shechem? But so he gives you this long argument. Shechem is near Shiloh. It is written in Joshua. Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. And at the end of that passage, the text explains that all these things occurred before God in Shiloh. It's not exactly written that way, but anyways, it's close to being written. Also in Judges, it is written, the feast of the Lord is now being held at Shiloh, and which lies on the highway that runs from Bethel to Shechem. So we see that, okay, Shiloh is on the highway between Bethel and Shechem, but still it's not the same place. Also in Jeremiah, it is written, men came from Shechem, from Shiloh, and from Samaria. That's not necessary. They're all in the same basic area that is called here Yehuda v'Shomron, or the West Bank, however you wish to refer to to that area here in Eretz Yisrael. There was a stretch of flat land in Shechem around the oak tree of Shechem where people could assemble to pay honor to the nearby tabernacle in Shiloh. So that's Rashbam's argument here. Despite this weakness, when I was writing my book about Rashbam on Genesis, I looked into this and I found that there were actually a couple of modern non-Jewish critics who came up with the same interpretation, Bible critics who came up with that same interpretation, that that's what Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh means, that it was a reference to the monarchy falling apart in the days of Rehoboam. Okay, so in the meantime, we don't see anything particularly anti-Christian about this, other than the fact that Rashbam is standing on his head to explain this passage as not being about the Messiah. And when we saw this passage before, we noticed that a lot of Jews did say that it was about the Messiah, and including Rashi, we mentioned that last week, that Rashi did not feel the necessity to come up with an interpretation that said that this wasn't about the Messiah. According to Rashbam, there's no reference here to the Messiah, but to some event that occurred in Jewish history 2,900 years ago. But here, Rashbam makes it clear why he is saying this. He writes, "This interpretation constitutes a refutation of the minim." So he's telling us, "I'm doing this because I know what the Christians say about this verse." She'ein katuv ki'im Shiloh shem ha'ir. Shiloh that's written here isn't, it's not a nickname for Jesus. It's just the name of a city. And then he continues, she'ein la'az ba'mikra. For there are no vernacular words in the Bible. He knew that there were some Christians who said that Shiloh was actually the word salut, S-A-L-U-T, and that it's, you know, because Jesus was supposed to be the Prince of Peace. So Shiloh is like the word salut, which is like the word shalom. And it says, no, there aren't vernacular words in the Bible, nor is Shiloh his written here, as some Jews claim, nor shaliach, a messenger, as the Christians say. Lo shelo katzu kan kedivrei ha'ivrim, velo shaliach kedivrei ha'notzrim. So if you look, I gave you on the left-hand side of the slide, the Unkelus's translation. He translates Shiloh as if it is the word shelo, delay, did delay. And the Septuagint seems to reflect the same kind of attitude. Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Bible from 2,200 years ago, until that which is stored up for him, the things that are for him, Shiloh, until thus shall come. But the translation of bottom on the right on this slide, you have the Latin translation, until when he at Quicki Nitendus est. Nitendus is the Hebrew, the Latin word for being sent. Mitera, meaning to send, the one who is sent. So Rashbam knows here and shows off his knowledge here that he knows how the Christians translated that word Shiloh as Nitendus, meaning the one who is sent, shaliach, as he writes here. Did Rashbam know Latin? Just to make it clear, the Vulgate is like the official translation of the Bible into Latin that the church was using in the days of Rashbam. Did Rashbam read Latin? No one can prove that he did or he didn't. Here he's making a reference to what it says in the Latin. So it could be that he knows about this because he read it, or it could be that he knows about it because he talked about it with Christians. And I'm much more inclined to the second understanding. How did one learn Latin? in 12th century France. As far as I know, there was only one way to learn Latin in 12th century France, and that was to get a priest to teach you Latin. There wasn't a university of Troyes that Rashbaum could go to and take a Latin course that was being taught in a non-denominational way. Most Christians did not read Latin either, and Latin was studied by the priests and not by the laity. It's not impossible that Rashbaum learned Latin. And as we go through, we're going to see one more example of Rashbaum making a reference to the Latin. But I would argue that it's more likely that it's just discussions that he had with Christians. Okay, so here we see that Rashbaum is admitting to us that he's offering this interpretation because it constitutes a refutation of the Christian understanding of the text, and he's continuing to point out the holes in the Christian understanding of the text that it says here in the Christian translation. It says "metendus," the one who is sent, and that's not what the word "Shiloh" means. It's like people getting confused between Shin Lamed Hey and Shin Lamed Chet. Hey and Chet are not the same letter, and so it doesn't make sense to say that it means the one who was sent. And then Rashbaum finishes off his comment and says, Jacob elaborated on the period of the true greatness of Judah, which was from the time of David to the time of Rehoboam, which isn't that many years, just the years of the kingship of David and the kingship of his son Solomon and the first years of Rehoboam. He didn't want to elaborate on the period of the diminution of that greatness. However, from that which is written, one infers that from Shiloh onwards, that greatness diminished. And so Rashbaum has one commonality with the Christians. The Christians understood this text here. When we look at the text here, that they're saying that Judah will have power until Shiloh comes, and then Judah will not have power, which they interpreted, beginning with Justin Martyr, as meaning that Jews will lose all their power once Jesus comes. Rashbaum uses that same pattern for interpreting the verse, but he's saying it means that the tribe of Judah will have the monopoly over monarchy until the events that happened in Shiloh, and then they will lose that that monopoly that they had on monarchy. Just because we're dealing with Genesis 49:10, I'll mention that there are a number of other interesting, I think this will be the last session that we talk about Genesis 49:10. So I just wanted to tell you that there is another very different Jewish way of understanding Genesis 49:10. And, you know, it's alluded to in this passage. There's a book called Nitzachon Yashan. There were two books called Sefer HaNitzachon, and the older one is called Nitzachon Yashan. Nitzachon in modern Hebrew means victory. In medieval Hebrew, it meant polemic. So this is the old book of polemic against Christianity. We'll probably say more in a later session about Nitzachon Yashan, but in the middle of this book of polemics against Christianity, there's this paragraph that isn't explained at all, where the author of Nitzachon Yashan, whose name we don't know, he was presumably a German Jew from the 13th or 14th century. He writes, it is written in their book, in the Gospel of Matthew, Joseph took his wife and knew her not till his firstborn son was born, who was called Jesus. And then, you know, if you look on the left, which is, you know, the Nitzachon Yashan was written in Hebrew, and you see he writes out the Latin of that verse in Hebrew letters. Yosef excipit conjugum suum et non cognoit iam. So why is the author of Sefer Nitzachon Yashan writing out this verse? So Obviously, the author of Nitzachon Yashan did know Latin, and he shows off his knowledge of Latin all the time, and he's transliterating this Latin verse into Hebrew letters, saying, "You might not believe me that that's what's written in the New Testament, but that's really what's written there. Here's what it says there in the Latin." I'm assuming that there are a number of people from Toronto who are listening to this session, and I assume that maybe one or two of them are as old as I am, or perhaps even older than I am, and were forced to learn Latin in high school. I never imagined when I went to the Community Hebrew Academy of Toronto that the Latin that I studied there would be useful for me in my career, but it has been very useful. So what's the author of Nitzachon Yashan doing here, just quoting and not saying anything about this? Well, what he is doing, he's following in the footsteps of a polemicist who lived just a little bit before him, named Solomon de Rossi, who lived in Italy in the 13th century, and who wrote a book called Edut Hashem Ne'emana, which is a book of polemics against Christianity. And he has a long discussion of Genesis 49:10, which finishes off with the following line. Kashya al hanotzrim. One may pose this difficulty to the Christians. Sha'omrim al Miriam, shahaita betula kodem haleita ve'achare haleita. You know, the Christians say that Mary was a virgin before she gave birth to Jesus and after she gave birth to Jesus. This is called, in the teachings of the Catholic Church, the doctrine of Mary's perpetual virginity. It isn't only that she gave birth to Jesus as a virgin, it's that she also died a virgin, that she remained. It's true, says that she was married to Joseph, but it was a sexless marriage. She remained a virgin all of her life. And this remains a doctrine of the Catholic Church today. It is not believed by most Protestants, but it has remained a doctrine. And then Solomon de Rossi writes, but it says in their gospels, he has this funny word in Hebrew letters, which I guess it's like the word evangelion or some banalio, shalahem katuba, hainu bebanalio shal sefer Matthew. Specifically in the gospel of Matthew, it says, he knew her not until she gave birth to her oldest son, implying that after that, he, Joseph, did know her. You know, the Christian, the verse says here, Joseph took his wife and knew her not until his firstborn son was born, who was called Jesus. So that implies he didn't know her until Jesus was born, which implies that afterwards he did know her. In other words, Solomon de Rossi and Sefer Nitzachon Yashan are saying, if you're going to read this verse here as saying, Judah will have power until Shiloh comes, and then until means, and then he will stop to have power, then you also have to read the verse in the New Testament that says that Mary was a virgin, that he knew her not until she gave birth to her oldest son. And then you obviously don't believe in the doctrines of in the doctrines of the Catholic Church. And this point, which is being said polemically and mockingly, actually, I think, as a student of the Bible, I think is a very, very good reading of the biblical text. And there's another famous verse that talks about until, ad, you know, ad ki yavo shiloh. There's this verse here when God is speaking to Jacob who's running away from the land of Israel, running away from his brother Esau. God says to him, remember, I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go. I will not leave you. Ad asheri masiti et asher dibarti lach, until I have done what I have promised to you. A number of Jewish commentators point out, in the same way that Rav Yosef Bechor Shor points out here, that sometimes the word until does not represent an end point. God isn't saying to Jacob, once I have done what I promised you, I will abandon you. That's not when it says, doesn't mean that then God will abandon him after he did what he promised him. But it means I will not leave you until I have done what I promised, and I will not leave you after that either. So the best understanding, I think, of Genesis 49:10 isn't that the verse is talking about an end point, which is the basis of the Christian understanding of the verse, but it's saying that, you know, if you say that this is messianic in the way that Rashi understood and many of the rabbis understood that it's messianic, it's saying that that Judah will continue to have power until the Messiah comes, and then he will also be from the tribe of Judah. Okay, so these are a number of the Jewish attempts to deal with Genesis 49:10, but what I found most interesting for our session here is Rashbam's insistence here, and admission here, I should say, that he's offering this interpretation because he knows what it is that the Christians are saying, and he's offering an interpretation that he thinks refutes their understanding of the text. The next time, moving on to the next example of Rashbam making a reference to what is written in the Vulgate, what's written in the Christian, official Christian Bible. On the commandment, Lo Tirtzach, which is sometimes translated as thou shalt not kill, and sometimes translated as thou shalt not murder, Rashbam writes, the verb ratzach, reish tzadichet, always, wherever it appears, this is, you can see this, insistent language, kol ratzicha, hariga b'chinam hi b'chol makom, wherever it appears, it always means unjustified homicide. For example, the murderer must be put to death, rotzeach. Would you murder and also take possession, haratzachta, where righteousness dwelt, but now murderers, meratzchim. But the verbs, hey, resh gimel, and mem vav taf, sometimes refer to unjustified homicide. For example, and he, Cain, killed him, his brother. And sometimes to justifiable homicide, a passage in Vayikra that talks about a woman who is guilty of a capital crime. It says, you shall kill the woman. Sometimes they use the word haragta. You know, this distinction is the distinction that we preserve in English. You can use kill for justified killing. If there's somebody coming to kill you and you kill them in self-defense, we will use the verb kill to describe what you did. But you'll also use kill to describe an unjustified killing. But murder, we reserve the verb murder for unjustified killing. If you're a soldier in a battle and you come back and you report to your commander that you were successful, you don't say, I murdered three of the enemy. We wouldn't say something like that in English. We would say, I killed three of the enemy, because we reserve the word murder for a killing that doesn't have any justification for it. And Rashbam insists here that the proper understanding of Lo Tirtzach is thou shalt not murder, and not thou shalt not kill. It's interesting to look through translations and see which ones agree with Rashbam and which ones don't agree with Rashbam. Then he goes on and says, Teshuvah laminim vehodu li. I offered this explanation as an argument against the minim, against the Christians, and they admitted that I was right. He said, I was in an argument with the Christians, and I told them this, and they admitted to me that I was right. Ve'afal pi sheyesh besifreihem ani amit ba'chaye belashon latin shelo tirtzach, heim lo dikdeku. And even though in their Latin books, the same verb is used to translate the verb mem vav taf in the phrase, I deal death and I give life. That's God speaking. And God isn't saying, I murder and I give life. God says, I'm responsible for people dying and I'm responsible for people coming to life, amit. And that same Latin verb is used to translate ratzach in this verse. Their translations are inaccurate. Heim lo dikdeku. And he's right. On the left-hand side here, you can see that that they used the same Latin verb in both of these verses. Non okides is lo tirzach in the Ten Commandments. And God speaking in Deuteronomy says, ego okidem et ego vivere faciam. And of course, you all recognize that root. Okides is the root of suicide and fratricide and homicide, all sorts of English words that have to do with killing have that CID element in them. And Rashbam knows that there is a mistake in the Vulgate. And he gets into discussions with Christians about the mistake in the Vulgate. And he reports that the Christians admit to him that he is right. I'm not going to go into the issue here, but if any of you are interested, I once actually wrote an article about this issue, about is Rashbam actually right? Does the Torah differentiate between murder and killing? If you don't have time to write down that link there, if you want to read my article, all you have to do is go to Google and write kill, murder, lakshan, and you will find the article that I wrote about the subject. But what I'm interested in here is Rashbam is telling us in his Torah commentary here, this is the second time that he's demonstrating his knowledge of what's written in the Christian text. And here he's admitting that he got into discussions with the Christians about the proper meaning of this verse. Yet another example where Rashbam says that he is offering an interpretation in order to undercut what it is that the Minim are saying, that the Christians are saying. The verse in the book of Exodus that says, before the Jews are to leave Egypt, they say, each woman shall sha'al. I didn't want to translate that verb sha'al because that's the crux of the question here. Sha'al from her neighbor and from the lodger in her house, objects of silver and gold and clothing, and you shall put these on your sons and daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians. Many translations of the Bible read here, each woman shall borrow from her neighbor these items. And this leads to a question about the morality of the Jews before leaving Egypt. Were they guilty of borrowing, in quotation marks, from the Egyptians, telling the Egyptians, we wish to borrow various items from you, when they had no intention of giving them back? Many Jewish commentators deal with this issue. Sha'al here, Rashbam writes, Sha'al in the middle of the slide, Sha'al here means to request as an outright and absolute gift. And that is why it says, God promises, I will dispose the Egyptians favorably to the people, because it's very strange that the Egyptians would give them a gift, but God says, I'm going to intervene and make sure that the Egyptians give them gifts. Similarly, sha'al means to request as an outright gift, not to borrow. In the verse, request it of me, and I shall make the nations your domain. So Rashbam is right. There are two senses of the verb lishol in biblical Hebrew. One sense is to borrow, and one sense is to ask for, to request. And even in modern Hebrew, lishol can mean to borrow, and lishol means I asked them for something, implying in some context, I asked that person to give that item to me. And then he writes at the end of this comment, Zehu ikar pshuto uchuva laminim. This interpretation is the true plain meaning of the verse, and it's an appropriate rebuttal for the heretics. What were the Christians saying? Well, I haven't succeeded, and as far as I know in my reading on the subject, I haven't found anybody else who succeeded in finding that the Christians specifically said here, that this passage shows the immorality of the Jews. However, there are many passages that I could quote from medieval Christian texts that do, where medieval Christians are claiming that the Jews were immoral. And so it's possible that Rashbam is hearing this claim on the streets of northern France. He's hearing, you Jews have always been immoral from the days when you were leaving Egypt. You borrowed this stuff and you never gave it back. It's also theoretically possible that when Rashbam writes here Tshuva Laminim, he's not referring to the Christians, because we know in classical Talmudic times that they tell stories of people before the Christians arguing that the Jews were immoral in their behavior when they left Egypt. But every other time that Rashbam uses the word minim, and we're going to see many examples this weekend, next week, of Rashbam using the word minim, it refers to the Christians. So it's more likely that it's referring to the Christians here. So he's saying that's what it means here. It doesn't mean to borrow, and so there's no moral blemish here in the behavior of the Israelites who sha'aled these items from the Christians. They asked them for them, and the Christians and the Egyptians said to them, "Just take. They're yours. You're not borrowing them." One of the leading medieval Jewish historians alive today, Professor Avraham Grossman, who lives here in Jerusalem, retired from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, wrote, I didn't translate this into English, I'll translate it as I read through the Hebrew. Ein tzarich lomar ad kama dechuka hatza'a zo. You don't have to say unreasonable interpretation Rashbam gave for this text. Alachat kama v'chama kasher tevazo choseret b'tzura shona mu'uchar yoter er v'ashem natan et chena am v'enei Mitzrayim v'yash ilum, because the verb actually appears later on in a different form, v'yash ilum, and lehash il means to lend, sha'al means to borrow, and lehash il means to lend. And so, yes, Omnam HaRashbam Peresh Leshitato Kiyam Medubar Be Matana Gemurach Lefarishken Paul Ze Bebinyan Hifil Rachok Od Yoter. And it's true, Rashbam read that verse, and Rashbam said, Vayashilum just means they fulfilled the request, that the Jews requested it, please give this to us, and they fulfilled the request, and that's what Vayashilum means. And Grossman says, that's so far-fetched, even more far-fetched than the argument about Sha'al. קשה להניח שהרשב"ם הדבק בקיצוניות יתרה בפשט הכתובים אכן חשב כי פירושו הוא הקרוב ביותר לאמת וכי יש להעדיפו על ההוראה הרגילה של פועל זה מלשון שאלה. He said, I can't imagine that רשב"ם, who loved פשט so much, actually believed that that's what this biblical verse means. And what this proves here is how much the desire to argue against Christians influenced Rashbam, even with his strong commitment to Pshat. He gave up his commitment to Pshat if he felt that polemics required it. Mistaber shu asaken kefi sheramaz bidvarav mishum ta'anat ha-nosrim. So Grossman said it must be what he heard the Christians saying, and he hinted that that's the reason that he's doing, but he doesn't really believe that these are what the words mean. Ki ha-yudim nagu shelo biyosher, that the Jews acted immorally here. העובדה שקרח מאחד גיסה יכתב את השיטה הפרשנית החדשה עם תשובה למינים ונאלץ מאידך גיסה לבחור בפשטים של הרמומיות מעידים לא רק על הקשר שבגן הפרשנות ובין הפלמוס אלא גם על החשש העמוק מן התעמולה הנוצרית ועל הניסיון להתמודד עימה בכל דרך אפשרית. This shows that how dangerous Rashbam felt the Christian claims about the Torah were, and how he felt that even if he had to come up with clumsy interpretations of biblical texts, he would offer them if they would help defend the faith, defend Judaism against the claims of the Christians. So that's what Grossman says. Grossman, the great medieval Jewish historian, says we see here how important anti-Christian polemics were for somebody like Rashbam, that he was even willing to offer a weak interpretation of the biblical verse if he felt that it served a polemical purpose. However, there are a number of modern Bible commentators, like my teacher, Professor Nachum Sarna, who say that v'sha'alah means shall request, which is the usual stem meaning of the root sha'al. He says that's the standard meaning, that the meaning of to borrow is the less regular meaning of the verse. And so Sarna thinks that that's what it means here. Vayashilu means, and they let them have their request. So I guess it's always possible that Professor Sarna was also indulging in anti-Christian polemics, but it's hard to believe that somebody living in the United States of America and who was friendly to his non-Jewish neighbors in Newton, Massachusetts, was indulging in anti-Christian polemics. So the question is, when Rashbam offered this interpretation, is Grossman right that he did it only because he's polemicizing against the Christians? Or is Sarna right that that's actually a good interpretation of the text? So those are the two possibilities. But in any case, we see yet another example of Rashbam saying, I am offering this interpretation because I know what it is that the Christians teach or that the Minim teach. And I am helping you. I'm writing this Bible commentary partially as a primer, as like a textbook to help you Jews who might find yourselves in arguments with Christians. This commentary will help you do this. Some of you might not be surprised, because you know how interested I am in Rashbam, that I will point out to you that I haven't finished what I have to say about Rashbam, and we will have to continue with Rashbam and the Christians next week. I have a few more things to say about Rashbam and the Christians, but for now I will stop sharing the screen, and I'll take a look at the questions and comments in the chat. Yes. So Ellen asks from the standard circles, you know, Ellen, I said that Rashbam was the first from the standard circles because I simply am not an expert in Karaite Bible commentators. And it is possible the Karaite Bible commentators indulged in arguments against Christianity. I know they did on occasion. So that's, I just like to protect myself. What about polemic al regel achad against Islam? I think that might have to be another lecture series, not al regel achad Irene asks, Abraham Ibn Ezra's third path on how to interpret the text in his commentaries on Torah as an attack on Christianity in such a way that he had probably read the New Testament. He's a little younger than Rashbam, and so I could go along with that. I'm not certain that Ibn Ezra had read the New Testament, but he certainly had knowledge about Christians, and he certainly was attacking the Christian understanding of the Bible. Yes, Steve points out that the translation of 49:10 differs from that of Hurst. The Jews in many ways to that. Gershon says, regarding your similarity of Justin's Diuke and holes in Swiss cheese, you can all read Gershon's puns there if you are so inclined. Yes, and Michael points out that you just have to look at at Rabbi Hertz's notes to see that he also feels the necessity of dealing with the Christological references and interpretations of this verse. Did Rashbam have friendly relationships with the Christians that he knew good enough for him to have theological discussions with them? This was sent to me privately, so I won't say the name of the person who asked that question. My answer is, tune in next week, where we will deal specifically with this question, and I'll tell you ahead of time that the answer is, could very well be. It's a good chance that that is the case. We'll see. It would be Madaiach on his firstborn son. Yes, and there's also references in the New Testament to Jesus' brothers and to Jesus' brothers, and so you know, the Catholic doctrine of the Catholic doctrine of virginity and perpetuity is such a difficult thing. And you know, when the Protestants came along, one of the first things they said was the Protestants went back to, you know, back to scriptures, and so they said that simply does not make any sense. Catholics accept that Jesus had a brother, Jacob. They say that means brother in the sense that Sam over here is my brother. Hello, Sam, brother. That's what it meant, the brother of Jesus. It meant the guy that he had this relationship with, that he was so close. That's what Catholics say. Protestants say it means that Jesus had a brother, that Mary had other children afterwards, after Jesus was born, and that one of them was named Jacob. Zeb says, doesn't her oldest son imply that she had other younger sons? Certainly, yes. Yes. Rashbam was not just an Oriental school, but an Occidental one. Okay. And Herb is saying, till Shiloh come, the Yerushalmi Peah, Sepharia, same time as church fathers, rabbis do not distinguish between Hay and Chet. Okay. Herb points out that you do have Midrashim. It is true that there are Midrashim where the Hay and the Chet. So it's not just, it's not just the Christians, who do this. Is De Rossi the same person who composed music? I was asked. To the best of my knowledge, no, but I think that it is the same family. This De Rossi is from the 13th century, and I don't think that the composer De Rossi was from, I think that he was a number of centuries after that, but I think it's the same family. How are we doing for time? We've got 2 minutes left. If anybody wants to unmute themselves and ask any other question, go right ahead.
Yes.
Can I just ask, because I'm from Shiloh, every time you mention Shiloh, I jump. Michal, but Shaul, that was also Admota, that she was no children ad mota, and the question was, did she never have children or did she die in childbirth?
Right. So there are very good, that same thing. And if you look at commentaries on that verse about Jacob, lo ezovcha ad asher asiti et asher dibarti lach, a number of the commentators say that sometimes ad means up to that point and then it stopped, and sometimes ad means forever, including, it's a way of saying forever.
And also the at Shiloh, the Mishkan was in Shiloh, was the
right.
the capital for 400 years, basically. I
right.
mean, the time of the judges was 400 years, and they say 369 years, the Mishkan, but the entire period from the entrance to the land of Israel until Shaul became king, the capital was Shiloh.
Right.
So
very good. So how far are you from Shechem?
I don't think I'm near Shechem at all.
Right, that's what I thought. You know, Rashbam, you know, I have great respect for Rashbam's Torah commentary, but his geography is not to be blamed for the fact that his, you know, the maps that were available to him in northern France of Eretz Yisrael were not great. People have written a lot about Rashi's maps. Rashi, in fact, tries to draw maps of Eretz Yisrael in places in his Torah commentary and in his Talmud commentary, and they're not all that exact. And Rashbam's knowledge of the geography of Eretz Yisrael is certainly not better than Rashi's, and perhaps worse.
A lot of it is based on mistakes of the Christians, like Nebuchadnezzar. Is probably not at all connected to the Ramah of Shmuel.
Right. Okay, wonderful seeing you all. And
Dr. Lakshin, I just got in a couple minutes ago, so thank you. I caught to in the middle of the question, so thank you very much. I was going to ask you, you said you had 2 minutes left. If there's any question, I was going to ask you for a 1 minute summary.
I got a 1 minute summary.
But that's, I'll have to listen later, but thank you very much. Yashar Koach, thank you. We look forward to next week, I guess, part two of the Rashbam, from what I gather you're saying.
Correct.
Okay.
That's right.
Part two.